Blog Talk Radio.
Appearance because of security concerns
sparked by demonstrations during a visit he made to Vancouver last fall. Cheney was scheduled to talk about his experiences in office and the current American political situation at the Metro Toronto Convention Center on April 24th. But Ryan Rupert of Spectra Live Corp said on Monday that Cheney and his daughter Elizabeth had begged off through their agent. After speaking with security advisors, they changed their mind on coming to the event, Rupert said. He said they decided it was better for their personal safety that they stay out of Canada. Last September 26, Cheney was forced to say hold up in the Vancouver Club for 7 hours before it was deemed safe for him to leave. Demonstrators blocked the entrances and at one point scuffled with police. Cheney critics accused him of endorsing the U.S. use of waterboarding and sleep deprivation against detainees while serving in former President George W. Bush's administration. Before the Vancouver event, Human Rights Watch urged the federal government to bring criminal charges against Cheney, accusing him of playing a role in the torture of the detainees.
So Cheney can't even go to Canada, which I'm glad.
He doesn't deserve to be able to.
I'm so very glad. And we got another article here I wanted to read tonight because it's from, where is it from? It was written by a guy named Ahmad Nadam and Ahmad Haroun from Reuters. And they were writing on the, reporting on the one shooter in Afghan murders. It's really debatable. According to this article, there was more than one person.
And you really don't know who's telling the truth because on both sides it's always an exaggeration and you never know who is manipulating what.
This guy was taken from the parent whose family was killed and the eyewitness of what happened. So I'm gonna take it for what it is. 16 Afghan civilians, including 9 children, were shot dead in what witnesses described as a nighttime massacre on Sunday near a U.S. base in southern Afghanistan, and one U.S. soldier was in custody. While U.S. officials rushed to draw a line between the rogue shooting and the ongoing efforts of a U.S. force of around 90,000, the incident is sure to further inflame Afghan terror, anger triggered when U.S. soldiers burned copies of the Quran at a NATO base. U.S. officials said an American staff sergeant from a unit based in Washington State was in custody after the attack on villagers in 3 houses. Multiple civilians were also wounded, a spokesman for the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force coalition said. President Obama called the Afghan counterpart, Hamid Karzai, promising to establish the facts quickly and to hold fully accountable anyone responsible. Well, there were conflicting reports of how the many shootings were involved, with U.S. officials asserting that a lone soldier was responsible, in contrast to witness accounts that several U.S. soldiers were present. The incident was one of the worst of its kind since U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. The U.S. Embassy in Kabul said U.S. Anti-U.S. reprisals were possible following the killings, just as the Quran burning incident a few weeks earlier had touched off widespread anti-Western protests, in which at least 30 people died. Neighbors and relatives of the dead said they had been a group of U.S. soldiers arrive at their village in Kandahar, Panjwayi district at about 2 a.m., enter homes and open fire. As an Afghan man who said his children were killed in a shooting spree accused soldiers of later burning the bodies. Obama said he was deeply saddened and the incident is tragic and shocking and does not represent the exceptional character of our military and represent that the United States has for people of Afghanistan, Obama said in a statement. We just like to shoot them, And Afghan President Karzai condemned the rampage as international murders, or intentional murders, and demanded an explanation from the United States. His office said the dead included 9 children and 3 women. I mean, that's sick, you know. Afghan officials also gave varying accounts of the numbers of shooters involved. Karzai's office released a statement quoting a villager as saying, "American soldiers woke my family up and shot them in the face." Minister of Border and Tribal Affairs, Asula Khalid, said a U.S. soldier had burst into 3 homes near his base in the middle of the night, killing a total of 16 people, including 11 people in the first house. The ISAF spokesman said the U.S. soldier walked back to the base and turned himself into U.S. forces this morning, adding there had been no military operations taking place in the area when the incident occurred. Panjwawi district is about 35 kilometers or 22 miles west of the provincial capital of Kandahar City. The district is considered the spiritual home of the Taliban and has been a hive of insurgent activity in recent years. "I saw that all 11 of my relatives were killed, including my children and grandchildren," said a weeping Haji Samad, who said he had left his home a day earlier, and blood-spattered walls. The walls of the house were blood-spattered. "The Americans poured chemicals over their dead bodies and burned them," Samad told Reuters at the scene. And neighbors said they had spoken to crackling gunfire from American soldiers, who they described as laughing and drunk. "They were all drunk and shooting all over the place," said neighbor Aga Ala, who visited one of the homes where the killings took place. "Their bodies were riddled with bullets." And a senior U.S. defense official in Washington rejected witness accounts that several apparently drunk soldiers were involved. "Based on preliminary information, we have this account is flatly wrong," this official said. "We believe one U.S. service member acted alone, not a group of soldiers." And Defense Secretary Leon Panetta called Karzai to offer his condolences. "I condemn such violence and I'm shocked and saddened that a U.S. service member is alleged to be involved, clearly acting outside his chain of command," Panetta said in a statement. A full investigation is already underway. "A suspect is in custody and I have President Karzai my assurances that we will bring those responsible to justice." Well, the Afghan Taliban said it would take revenge for the deaths in an email statement to the media. The U.S. Embassy in Kabul said an investigation was underway and that the individual or individuals responsible for this act will be identified and brought to justice. The ISAF Commander General John Allen promised a rapid investigation. But civilian casualties have been a major source of friction between Karzai's Western-backed government and U.S.-led NATO forces in Afghanistan. And NATO is preparing to hand over all security responsibilities to Afghans, and all foreign combat troops are scheduled to leave by the end of 2014. And NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen said the alliance remained firmly committed to its mission and said anyone responsible would be held accountable. But the Quran burning and the violence that occurred, that followed, including a spat of deadly attacks against U.S. soldiers, underscored the challenges that the West faces as it prepares to withdraw. And Sunday's attack may harden a growing consensus in Washington that despite a troop surge, a war bill exceeding $500 billion, how about $1 trillion? Okay, over 10 and a half years and almost 2,000 U.S. lives lost, prospects are dimming for what the United States can accomplish in Afghanistan. These killings only serve to reinforce the mindset that the whole war is broken and that there's little we can do about it beyond trying to cut our losses and leave, said Joshua Faust, the security expert with the American Security Project. So,
pretty sad.
You got to get out of there, folks. You know, you got to just get the hell out of there. We didn't want to go in there to begin with.
Nope. It had nothing to do with what the people
wanted. It had nothing to do with anything. And they didn't do 9/11 either. The South did 9/11 very well known.
This is from the Independent British paper, Unreported Rapes, The Silent Shame by Nina Lakhani. The devastating scale of sexual violence against women in Britain is exposed today by new research, which indicates that the vast majority of victims do not report perpetrators to the police. 1 in 10 women has been raped, and more than a third subjected to sexual assault, according to a major survey, which also highlights just how frightened women are of not being believed. More than 80% of the 1,600 respondents said they did not report their assault to the police, while 29% said they told nobody, not even a friend or a family member, of their ordeal. Negative social attitudes toward rape and sexual assault victims plays a big part in the reluctance of women to come forward, the survey by Mumsnet suggests. Nearly three-quarters of respondents feel the media is unsympathetic to women who report rape, while more than half say the same is true of the legal system and society in general. The findings come as the social networking site launches a campaign to dispel the myths surrounding sexual violence, which it says stops victims from assessing support and justice. The week-long We Believe You campaign is backed by Rape Crises, Bernardo's, and the End Violence Against Women Coalition. Fear of being blamed because of their clothes or alcohol intake or staying with an abusive partner means more than half of the women surveyed in February and March 2012 said they would be too embarrassed or ashamed to report the crime. The stubbornly low conviction rate still put off 68% of victims from going to the police, but perhaps even more surprising is the fact that 29% said they did not tell anyone, not even friends or family, about the rape, while 53% said they would be reluctant to do so because of shame or embarrassment. Mumsnet wants to convey that every rape is as serious as the next, despite the contrary and controversial assertion by Justice Minister Ken Clark last year. Justine Roberts, co-founder of Mumsnet, said, "It is shocking and unacceptable that this number of women have been raped and sexually assaulted. But the standout fact is that so few who would report it to officials or even to loved ones because of the general perception society is unsympathetic. If our campaign can dispel the myths and help women realize how commonplace it is, they might feel more emboldened to get help." Of the women who reported being sexually attacked or raped in the survey, almost a quarter said the crime had happened 4 times or more, and in two-thirds of cases, the perpetrator was someone the victim knew. Home Office figures indicate more than 1 in 5 rapes are reported as perpetrated by partners or ex-partners. Yet the belief that rapes happen outside in dark alleyways to women scantily dressed is among the most pervasive and harmful. It means women raped at home do not identify the experience as rape or report it. One Mumsnet user wrote, "It makes people view rapists as monsters, which is true, and therefore the man who lives over the road or the man who works in accounting on your husband's friend's returns couldn't possibly be rapists, which unfortunately isn't true, because they're normal, decent human beings. However, the government is trying to restrict legal aid access for some domestic violence victims as part of its proposals to cut the annual bill by £350 million. Last week, The Independent revealed funding from local authorities to organizations working with domestic violence and sexually abused victims, and that fell also. A spokesman for the Ministry of Justice has said, "The government has ring-fenced nearly £40 million over the next 3 years for specialists, local domestic and sexual violence support services." And here is a case study. My life was a pattern of rapes, sorries, and treats. Mary, not her real name, suffered serious abuse at the hands of her former partner. Now 37, this is good news, she is happily married and lives in the West Midlands. That's in England. "I met the man of my dreams when I was 23 and my daughter was 2 years old. He was handsome, educated, and had a gorgeous smile. Then one night he asked me if I fancied one of his mates. I didn't realize at first what the plan was. It happened so fast and I was so out of it that after a while, In trying to move away from him, I just lay there and let his friend rape me. The next time my boyfriend raped me was a few months later. Everything hurt. My legs were bruised with finger marks. I was bleeding. He had torn me with the force. The months went by. We followed a regular pattern, clubbing, parties, new friends, rape, treats, and beatings. He'd always make it up to me with expensive presents, flowers, and a million sorries. I dropped 2 stones, that's a lot of weight, and my parents were so worried I'd hardly seen them or any friends. I couldn't tell anyone about my life. I was scared that they would tell me to leave him. I thought I'd be the one to change him. If I loved him enough, he'd stop hurting me. One night he started to shout at my daughter because she was crying. Then he lunged towards her in a real rage. I knew we'd die or be seriously injured if we didn't leave. We lived in a hostel for 3 long months before we were housed by a housing association. I remember driving past the refuge a few years ago and seeing it reduced to a pile of rubble. I find the fact that Katsa to me made real worrying. The thought of women and children not having that resource frightens me. What will they do if there are no counselors to talk to? I found it incredibly hard to talk about my ordeal, and even now I can't say certain things out loud. One thing I'll take with me from my time with my ex is that he used to say, first you F the body, and then you F leak the mind. And he would actively seek out single mothers to rescue. I found out after I'd left that he actually planned to lure women into his web of lies and beatings. It has taken me a very long time to come to terms with my ordeal, to trust a man again. And even now there are days when I wait for the bubble to burst and everything in my life to fall apart. Oh, what a story. And they are cutting aid to rape victims in England, and women are afraid to report it or feel ashamed. That's terrible.
Well, here's kind of an encouraging, I don't know, encouraging, but it's not bad. Al Jazeera employees resign over the channel's bias.
Oh, I saw that.
I thought that was interesting because this was written yesterday. Many employees at Al Jazeera, and this is from Press TV.
Huh. Is this Al Jazeera?
No. What?
Are these American employees or just employees in general?
These employees in general. I believe they were
Arab
employees.
Hmm.
Because they said many employees at Al Jazeera News Channel are resigning over the Qatari-based news network biased coverage of events taking place in the Middle East. While Al Jazeera has gained a reputation for its coverage of the Tunisian, Egyptian, and Libyan revolutions, the broadcaster has remained almost silent over massive anti-government protests in Bahrain and Manama. Manama's brutal crackdown on the popular. I didn't even hear about Manama.
Bahrain?
The protests in Bahrain. Manama must be the ruler. Al Jazeera is also accused of blowing the opposition movement in Syria out of proportion and covering up the truth in the country. It's also accused of fabricating whole stories about Libya and Syria, and even staging its own footage at undisclosed locations. As Al Jazeera is also said to be forcing editors to give the stories a twist to benefit the state of Qatar's political views. It is widely believed that the Imam of Qatar has a direct influence on the nature of programs broadcast in Al Jazeera. The Qatari-based network biased policy toward Bahrain and Syria has caused dispute among the news network workers. Many employees at bureaus across the world, including Lebanon, have left their jobs over Al Jazeera's biased stance against the Syrian government and in favor of the Bahraini regime. The latest person to quit was a key manager.
Wow.
So that's kind of interesting to hear what happened there.
I'm going to read what the lower house of Parliament in Egypt. They're saying Israel is Egypt's number one enemy, an MP declares. This was written yesterday. It doesn't say by whom or even who published this. The lower house of...
That was by Press TV.
Press TV. The lower house of the Egyptian parliament has unanimously approved a text declaring that Israel is the number one enemy of Egypt and calling for the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador and a halt to gas exports to Israel. On Monday, Egyptian MPs voted by a show of hands on the text of a report, which was compiled by the Arab Affairs Committee of the People's Assembly, that's the lower house of parliament there, and I quote, "Revolutionary Egypt will never be a friend, partner, or ally of the Zionist entity, which we consider to be the number one enemy of Egypt and the Arab nation." The report declared, adding, "It will deal with that entity as an enemy, and that the Egyptian government is hereby called upon to review all of its relations and accords with that enemy." In 1979, Egypt became the first Arab country to sign a peace treaty with Israel, but was compelled to agree to supply gas to Israel as one of the main economic conditions of the U.S.-sponsored peace deal. According to the results of an opinion poll conducted by Sinovate for Press TV, and published on October 3rd, 2011, an overwhelming majority of Egyptians opposed the terms of the country's gas deal with Israel. In the poll, 73% of the respondents said they were opposed to gas exports to Israel. Only 9% said they approved of Egypt supplying gas to Israel. And Press TV, Israel is Egypt's number one enemy. Let's see, let me just see what this is. The issue of supplying gas to Israel has always been a contentious topic for Egyptians who view Israel as an enemy and oppose engaging in any form of business with them. According to a $2.5 billion export deal with Tel Aviv signed in 2005, Israel receives around 40% of its gas supply from Egypt at an extremely low price. That's going to hurt.
Yeah. So.
That's if that passes. That's
see, that was made by by the former president, Mahmoud.
Yeah.
Mubarak.
Mubarak. They threw him out, so.
So, anyway. You have one more on the Middle East that I wanted to bring up. You don't hear anything in the mainstream about Gaza.
No.
Or about what they're doing over there. And they're not doing too well. Israeli occupation forces continue their offensive on Gaza for four consecutive days. Five Palestinians, including a child and an old man and his daughter, killed, and 38 others wounded since yesterday afternoon. Raising deaths to 23 and injuries to 73. That was just in the last 4 days. Israeli occupation forces have continued the military offensive on the Gaza Strip, which they initiated on Friday evening, March 9th. Today, three Palestinian civilians have been killed and 36 others, including 19 children and 7 women, have been wounded. Two members of the resistance have been killed, and two others have been also wounded by a series of Israeli airstrikes. Thus, the number of Palestinians killed since the beginning of this offensive has been 23, and the number of wounded has been 73, most of them civilians. And investigations conducted by the Palestinian Center of Human Rights into alleged crimes committed by Israeli occupation force from Friday evening until Monday noon indicates the following. And this was written by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights.
Might want to close that window.
Yeah.
Why don't you do that?
Why don't you finish that?
Let me just pick up where at approximately 1:40 on Monday, 12th of March, 2012, an Israeli warplane fired a missile at an agricultural plot on Norwegian Street in the east side of Al Shavasia neighborhood in the east side of Gaza City. A number of nearby houses were damaged, and 18 and Alam RF Judea, 18, was injured on her forehead by fragments of glass while she was at home. At around 2 o'clock, also on Monday, an Israeli warplane fired a missile at a house belonging to Bahat Hamad near an elementary school in Isbat in the northern Gaza Strip town of Jabaya. The missile hit the first floor of the three-story house where 9 individuals, including 3 children, lived. As a result, the house was completely destroyed and 7 members of the family, including 3 children and 3 women, were wounded. 18 neighboring houses were also affected by the missile. 3 of them sustained heavy damage. 12 members of a family, including 3 children, 2 women, and 7 members of another family, including 5 children, were also wounded. The houses of the 2 families are adjacent to the targeted house. In addition, 350 windows, 7 wooden and 3 iron doors in the above school were damaged. 2 windows from the Palestinian Red Crescent Society premises were also destroyed.
And,
at approximately
2:30, Israeli warplane fired a missile at an empty area in Abusan village, east of the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis. No casualties were reported. But at approximately 6:30, approximately 5:40, an Israeli warplane fired a missile at Hamada Salman Hamadu Mutla, 20, from Hassan village, east of Khan Yunis, a member of the Al-Quds Brigade, the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad. When he was near Abu Bakr,
Mosque
in Abu Salman village, Abu Matlak was instantly killed by shrapnel throughout his body. And additionally, windows of the 3 nearby houses were destroyed, injuring the head of a two-year-old
child.
At approximately 6:10, an Israeli warplane fired a missile at Sarah Hill in the east of Al Surayya neighborhood in the east of Gaza City. There are no casualties there, but at 6:40,
of property.
An Israeli warplane fired a missile at an empty area in that neighborhood in the east of Gaza. And approximately 7, it goes on and on. It's just clobbered them.
I wonder what the total was of people killed.
Well, they said 76. 76 wounded. And stresses of the Israeli occupation forces committing grave breaches of international humanitarian law for using excessive and disproportional force and disregard for the lives of Palestinian civilians. Calls upon the international community to immediately take an action to stop such crimes and reiterates its call to the high contracting parties to the 4th Geneva Convention to fulfill their obligations under Article 1, which stipulates the high contracting parties undertake to respect and ensure respect to the present convention of all circumstances, blah, 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 blah. All right, so the interesting thing here, and to be fair, not that we're being fair here, but I don't think the Israelis are fair at all, but... supposedly there was a report I read yesterday, and I couldn't go through it, unfortunately. But it was there was over 200 or nearly 200 rockets that were sent into Israel.
Okay, wow.
That instigated this retaliation. Right, and Hamas declares that they weren't responsible for it, and Hamas is the ruling
entity there.
Gaza.
Government,
but it's the Palestinian Jihad, I believe, militant group that have been launching them. So there's so many factions within the factions, you know.
Yeah, you don't know who's responsible for anything.
And it's a frightening situation. But anyway, this report is from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. They documented each attack and what happened there.
I don't know whether we can take a music break on this computer, whether it'll actually play.
I think we can.
We'll see if we'll be able to hear it.
Let's see if it works.
So we'll try a little music break.
Thank you.
you tonight. One is this thing about windmills.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'd like to read that.
I think we should do that tonight. That one, that was very short, but it was very disturbing.
Well, this is terrible.
I got that from the Intel Hub.
That report on windmills is very interesting, too.
I thought so, too.
I was surprised, but maybe we can both read that one.
Yeah,
but let me just read this first, because it's short. We'll press the wrong button. Maya suspends entire police force over tasing of a 9-year-old. The mayor of Mount Sterling, Ohio, has suspended the entire police force for 3 days after an officer tased a 9-year-old child, and the police subsequently covered it up. The small town, with a population just under 2,000, is now being policed by the sheriff's department, while a state investigation into the police chief and the 5 part-time police officers takes place. At some point, the visit became hostile, and the part-time officer allegedly used a taser to subdue the boy. The police chief, that's a quote, the police chief is accused of hiding the incident from village leaders, reported the Huffington Post. 6 different marks on his back, and you know in 3 different places. They look like burns. The tasing of a 9-year-old boy is absolutely unacceptable and a disgusting display of police brutality that must not go unpunished. That's from the Intel Hub. That's unbelievable.
You know, we got a little bit of news. An article on the Global Warming Policy Foundation has produced yet another devastating report. This time on the economics of wind farms. Turns out they're even worse than we thought.
I mean, this is a surprise,
yeah,
isn't it?
No, it's getting out there because they're a sick, stupid idea. Not only do the bat-chomping eco-crucifixes ruin views, kill birds, cause bats to implode, destroy the British film industry, frighten horses, enrich rent-seeking toffs like David Cameron's father-in-law, Sir Reginald Sheffield BT.
In other words,
drive up electricity bills, kill jobs, create fuel poverty, cause old people to die of hypothermia, wipe out property values, drive people mad with strobings and noise pollution, and enable smug liberal idiots to spout rubbish like, oh, I don't mind them. Actually, I think they're rather beautiful. And also, it's 2020. But also, by 2020, they're set to drive up consumer bills in the UK alone by $120 billion.
They won't think they're so cute then.
This is about 10 times more than it would cost if we stuck to gas, which we have in abundance, just waiting to be exploited in places like the Bolan Shale. In the latest Spectator, Mitt Ridley delivers a coup de grace, and here's a taste. To the nearest whole number, the percentage of the world's energy that comes from wind turbines today is 0. Despite their regressive subsidy, pushing pensioners into fuel poverty while improving the wine cellars of grand estates, despite tearing rural communities apart, killing jobs, despoiling views, erecting pylons, felling forests, killing bats and eagles, causing industrial accidents, clogging motorways, polluting lakes in Inner Mongolia with the toxic and radioactive tailings from refining neodymium, a ton of which is in the average turbine. Despite all of this, the total energy generated each day by wind has yet to reach 0.5% worldwide.
Amazing.
If wind power was going to work, it would have done so by now. The people of Britain see this quite clearly, though politicians are only willfully deaf. The good news, though, is that if you look closely, you can see David Cameron's government coming to its senses about the whole fiasco. The biggest investor in offshore wind, Mitsubishi, that's right, Gamesha and Siemens, are starting to worry that the government's heart is not in wind energy anymore. Vestas, which has plans for a factory in Kent, want reassurance from Prime Minister that there is the political will to put up turbines before it's building to build its factories. Well, I can understand that, but at the same time,
I wonder how popular it is here in this country. It's
out there, but they're not talking about it.
Yeah, we don't really hear
it's
much
there,
about
it's
it.
It's there in the Midwest. And T. Boone Pickens is
trying to put it up all over.
Trying to put it up.
And Tex Mara said his interest in energy is really to get all. He wants the water rights.
He wants the water rights everywhere.
To withhold that from everybody.
Some readers may occasionally detect in my coverage of wind farms a mild hint of contempt for those involved in the wind farm industry, whether as lawyers that means you, Mr. Nick Clegg, paid propagandist disruptors, see commenters below, but rent seekers or corporatist bloodsuckers feeding off the backs of innocent taxpayers. One thing is certain, the argument against wind farms are so abundant and well-known that ignorance is no longer a plausible excuse. If you're involved in the wind farm industry, you're a weapons-grade tosser. Simple as that.
Okay. And here's something that people might be interested in. 1 out of every 10 Wall Street employees is likely a clinical psychopath, writes journalist Sherry DeCoveney in an upcoming issue of a trade publication, CFA Magazine. A subscription's required for that. In the general population, the rate is closer to 1%. A financial psychopath can present as a perfect, well-rounded job candidate, CEO, manager, co-worker, and team member, because their destructive characteristics are practically invisible, writes DeCoveney, who pulls together research from several psychologists for her story, which helpfully suggests that financial firms carefully screen out extreme psychopaths in hiring. To be sure, a typical psychopathic behavior runs the gamut. At the extreme is Bateman, portrayed by Christine Bale in the 2000 movie American Psycho, and as an investment banker who actually kills people and exhibits no remorse. When health professionals talk about psychopaths, they have a broader range of behavior in mind. A clinical psychopath is bright, gregarious, and charming, writes DeCoveney. He lies easily and often and may have trouble feeling empathy for other people. He's probably also more willing to take dangerous risks, either because he doesn't understand the consequences or because he simply doesn't care. An appetite for risk can seem like a positive business trade on Wall Street, where big gambles sometimes lead to big rewards. But for the people DeCoveney is talking about, the outcomes matters less than the gambles themselves, and the chemical rush of serotonin and endorphins that accompanies them. This is hardly the first time that mental illness has been equated with a certain capacity for professional success, especially in the financial sector, where some stock traders have actually scored higher than diagnosed psychopaths on tests that measure competitiveness and attraction to risk. Some psychologists have long claimed that the qualities that make for a high-achieving politician or stockbroker are also the same traits that psychopaths have in abundance. Other researchers generalize it to bosses as a species, saying that about 4% of all executives are psychopaths, and that their relative lack of scruples is what helps them excel in business. At the same time, the fast-moving, high-pressure environment of Wall Street probably compromises the mental health of some of its employees. A recent study found that many young bankers develop alcoholism, insomnia, eating disorders, and other stress-related ailments within just a few years on the job. Stockbrokers have also been shown to experience clinical depression at a rate more than 3 times as high as the general population. DeCoveney writes that for someone with a latent compulsive gambling problem, a job trading stocks can trigger pathological responses that send that person into an escalating pattern of lies, deaths, embezzlement, and fraud. A person with this problem would feel gratified by an enormous loss because of the way their brain's reward system works, which Duchovny says may explain the activities of such notorious rogue traders as Kiwiku Abdu-Oboli, Jerome Kerviel, and Nick Leeson. The three men who gambled and lost the combined equivalent of $10.3 billion for their respective institutions over the past 17 years. Want to find places that have a better work-life balance than Wall Street? Here are the best countries with the best work-life balance. Denmark is number one. Norway is number two. The Netherlands is number three. Finland is number four. Belgium is five. Switzerland is six. Sweden is seven, Germany eight, Portugal nine, and France 10. We're not even probably close to that level.
We're in the 1,000.
Yeah, bottom.
We're in the bottom. Joy. I want to read this. This is from David Icke's site. But he has a friend called Credo Mutswa. And Credo is a Zulu shaman, and if you go to his site, you'll see interviews with him and stuff that he, Credo Mudwa wrote about Barack Obama in 2008, before he was sworn in as U.S. president, and these were his statements. An actor walks upon the floodlight stage of life wearing a mask of an angel beneath a demon's gown. Pretense smiles upon the crowded hall of life, holding out hope as bright as it is false. Son of a woman in whose veins flow the blood of ancient Ireland and dark Africa's plains, you are Obama. Nicknamed the Standing King. You are Barack, O son born to deceive. The suffering hordes of Africa look up to you. See a black savior where not but a Judas strides. An entrapper of nations, bringer of dismal war. Behind the robes and nylon wings of hope, O may those who look upon you see you as you are. May those who hope in you behold you as you be, a prince deceitful to bring about Africa's shrines, bring down Africa's shrines. A siren to lead Africa's ships into rocks of obliteration. Your rule, my lord, will not be one of peace. Your reign, my king, will not be one of smiles. And even as we speak in caves both dark and dank, engaged fanatics plot your dark demise, and they will put around your head a blood-wet martyr's crown. O Black Kennedy, following the one before. And may God forgive thee and thy fiery spouse as you walk in silence from the stage of life. Barack Obama, blessed son, standing king.
Sounds like he's going to be assassinated.
That's what he seems to see.
That's what he saw.
And interestingly enough, Tom Paine, the author of the Template of Time,
mm-hmm.
Remember we've had it on
yep.
a few times, and he predicted accurately the downfall of Mubarak. But in Egypt, he predicted that fall, that uprising. But he also said in the last show we did with him that he saw the assassination of Obama,
mm-hmm.
That would happen this year. So, that's...
So the possibility is there. People are seeing it.
Yeah, it's there. He's a much-hated guy. So,
that's for sure.
By many, many people around the world.
The EFF warns of Big Brother biometrics time bomb. The passing of a new law in France, paving the way for a biometric database and requiring all citizens to carry a biometric ID card, is a time bomb for civil liberties, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has warned. On Tuesday, the French National Assembly passed a law for the creation of a national biometric database, ostensibly to fight identity fraud. However, the EFF warns that the biometric databases pose a mission creep threat, since the data can be used for reasons beyond identity fraud. It points out that governments are increasingly demanding storage of citizens' biometric data on chips embedded into identity cards or passports and centrally held on government databases with little regard to citizens' civil liberties. The new laws compel the creation of an ID card that will contain information such as fingerprints, photographs, home address, height, and eye color. New passports will also contain the chip. A second optional chip will be created for online authentication for e-government services and e-commerce. EFF points out that France doesn't have a good track record for protecting biometric information. Last year, the French government confirmed that 10 PC of biometric passports in circulation were fraudulently obtained. The EFF describes the new law as invasive and could bring undue interference into people's lives. It also warns that the passing of the law is disproportionate, and one motive could be to prop up French smart card and biometric companies who have been lobbying heavily for the creation of a biometric ID card. History has shown that databases in France created for one purpose have been used for others. In 1998, for example, France created a DNA database of sex offenders, but its scope was expanded to include data from those convicted of other serious violent criminal offenses and terrorism. The database was later expanded to include the data of those who committed a wide range of offenses. Anyone suspected of any crime is now compelled to submit a DNA sample as well. Moreover, the measure is non-proportionate, given that there are less than 10,000 annual instances of fraudulent identity documents reported in France. It is difficult to argue that this justifies fingerprinting and face digitization of an estimated 45 million individuals in storing this information in a central biometric database.
There you go.
So anyway.
We got about 3 minutes, so let's see what we got. Here's a quickie.
Yeah.
Say no to cuts. Spain demos oppose labor reform. I guess that means demonstrations.
I must be.
Yeah. It says here, people take part in a protest march against the government's new labor reform in Barcelona, Spain, on March 11, 2012. Hundreds of thousands of Spaniards have taken to the streets to protest the labor law reform. The demonstrations organized by labor unions have paved the way for a nationwide strike plan for March 29. Workers are objecting to what they see as empowering employers at the expense of the employees under the pretext of an anti-crisis austerity policy. The protest hit some 60 cities and towns across Spain, and largest reported in Madrid, Barcelona, Seville, and Valencia. The changes to labor legislation have been confirmed by the Spanish Parliament Thursday. The reforms affect most worker entitlements, making the dismissal of employees simpler. Reducing salaries, increasing working hours, and other measures favoring employers. The government is aiming at revitalizing the economy, which is among those suffering most from the ongoing European recession. Prime Minister Marino Rajoy wants to prove to investors that Spain will not require a bailout to overcome its problems, like Greece, Ireland, and Portugal. Opponents of the reform say it does nothing towards creating new jobs in the country and represents profound social regression. Spain currently has the highest unemployment rate, nearly 23%, among the Eurozone members. And the previous austerity package introduced by Spain's government in 2010 resulted in a general strike in late September. While the Spanish government is struggling to deal with the crisis, citizens on the ground are looking for their own way to make their lives a little better. And the municipality of Villamayor de Santiago in country center saw a resurgence of the old Spanish currency and the peseta as an alternative to the troubled euro, reports Russian TV Serb. So that's kind of interesting.
Okay, let's put on his...
Yeah, next we will have Woody in the ring. And here it is.
Sports fans, watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, NFL news, NBA, a little NHL, and even some baseball. A little bit of everything tonight. Let's start off with something they rarely talk about. We'll go to the NHL. NHL Senior Vice President of Player Safety, Brendan Shanahan, says he is bothered when he hears players don't respect each other anymore because he has video evidence to the contrary. Now, what some people may or may not know is, much like the NFL, the NHL is on a player safety crusade as far as we're going with concussions and stuff like that, head injuries. Monday, he showed NHL general manager several video clips of players who had the opportunity to level a vulnerable player and didn't take the shot. In one example, San Jose Sharks captain Joe Thornton took a stride to his right to make sure he hit the Montreal Canadiens defenseman P.K. Subban from a far less dangerous position. Every night we see players making good decisions and better decisions about delivering hits. He also disputed the suggestion that while headshots are down, kneeling, clipping, and running the goalie are on the rise. The raw numbers of those penalties are roughly the same as last season. The GMs won't fully address rule changes until today, but a proposal to alter the league's 75-year-old icing rule is gaining support. Under the existing rule, a forward can negate an icing call by touching the puck before a defenseman once it crosses the goal line. Under the new hybrid icing proposal, a forward can negate icing by beating the defenseman to the face-off dot in the defensive zone. Kind of interesting. You know, that's a major rule change. You know, as I said, that's a 75-year-old icing rule. So that's a big idea. The idea is to avoid players getting hurt by crashing into the boards while chasing the puck. You know, so it's more, again, more of some safety stuff. But if you go over the raw numbers, they're suspending people for dirty play more now than they ever have before. The concussion numbers are actually up 3%. So, you know, the changes they're making aren't working. I really don't think the players have much respect for other players. I think it's, you know, kind of the same thing as going on in the NFL, the win at all costs with the bounty type stuff. It's the same kind of thing. Frankly, if you're an adult, I don't see too, you know, it's kind of sad if that's what the games are coming to. But what is even more sadder is that this will translate into lower forms of the game, such as peewee football and peewee, you know, hockey and stuff like that. And when you got kids doing the win-at-all-cost stuff and doing bounties and hurting other kids and things like that, you know, because this is what they're doing up in the big leagues. You know, that's the kind of negative stuff that, you know, you just don't want happening, but, you know, it does. So, but again, you know, the NHL is, you know, they're making efforts, but, you know, they're failing. Speaking of failing, embattled the Knicks coach, Mike D'Antoni, who, by the way, I said at the beginning of the season would be fired, and Phil Jackson will be the coach of the New York Knicks. He feels the weight of the world is upon him and his club. After hearing a brief fire D'Antoni chant Sunday at the Garden, the coach admitted the team's psyche and spirit have reached a low point just weeks after the Knicks were on top of the sports world with that Linsanity bullshit, which I knew was total garbage. Well, when things get tough in New York, we're down two. We call it timeout, D'Antoni said, before the Knicks tipped off against my Bulls last night, who, of course, beat the Knicks. We felt like we were down 20 points. When you feel that as a team and a coach, you got to change that around. It's like the world's coming to an end and we're losing that ability to come back from eight down. The Knicks, 18-23, brought their five-game losing streak to Chicago to face Eastern Conference top team, the Bulls, my Bulls, that is, when they'll meet in the first round of the playoffs. Weeks ago, a feel-good story, the Knicks are no longer a playoff lock after going 2-7 since the return of, you know, supposed all-star Carmelo Anthony, who returned from an injury. Going into last night, they led the Bucks and Cavs by just one game for the last playoff spot. Anthony was booed at the Garden on Sunday, and the trade line deadline looms. It's Thursday. It's clear there is no love lost between D'Antoni and Anthony, and one will be gone sooner or later, and it's going to be D'Antoni, obviously. He's, you know, he's definitely out of there. There's no more excuses because the club is, you know, back virtually at full strength. They're missing big man backup Jared Jeffries, but for the most part, they're a full squad now. And the last game before the trade deadline and activity around the NBA is expected to be minimal because of a lockout condensed season. D'Antoni said Lynn also is feeling the weight of the world but continues strenuously to defend his point guard. I'm not real concerned, D'Antoni, whose future is closely tied to Lynn's. If we get everything straight and make everything easier for him, we're making it harder for him now. Whenever the psyche's not right, the point guard feels it most. Probably an inexperienced one, I feel a lot more. We'll feel it a lot more. My personal opinion on Lynn is I think he might be a great sixth man. I don't think he's the answer at point guard. But, you know, I mean, frankly, I think I would throw Baron Davis in there and have Lynn, you know, be like your best six-man type deal. I mean, that's just my personal opinion. I'm not sure. You know, if the Knicks want to build around Lynn, he can be re-signed for the Knicks at like a $5 million mid-level exception, and the team has the right to match any free agent offer. Much to Lynn's chagrin, D'Antoni probably is the one who won't be offered a contract extension, even though Lynn's sanity never would have happened if he was not running the speedball attack, which gives the point guard all the freedom making, you know, decisions and stuff. But, you know, I mean, Anthony heard boos from the crowd during player intros when he decided to take a three-point shot on the fast break instead of passing. You know, the Knicks are just, you know, in a world of shit right now, you know. It's just, it's funny. You know, that Linsanity thing was going on, and they could do no wrong with, like, they were walking on water, and boom, just like that, things have gone, you know, straight into the toilet for them. Some interesting stuff going on in the NFL. A lot of free agents are up for grabs. And obviously Peyton Manning is the most sought-after free agent, you know, as he travels, you know, around to a couple of cities. Obviously, the team that was most expecting, or at least their fans, acted like they were expecting to receive Peyton Manning. I would be referring to the New York Jets, Jets. They are not going to get Peyton Manning. They signed the franchise to a three-year contract extension. Now, for the most part, it is basically kind of like a cosmetic job. You know, it's more show than go. My personal opinion is if the franchise doesn't get it done after next season, they're going to be actively shopping for another quarterback for the answer. And, you know, I think they might even be shopping on the low. I'm sure they're scouting, you know, all kinds of college guys as we speak, because I don't think they have a whole lot of faith in him, but they're kind of stuck with him for now because, you know, Peyton Manning kind of turned his nose at the Jets, and, you know, those are just the breaks. Now, as far as Peyton Manning goes, he added one and perhaps two more teams to his list of candidates yesterday in a free agent job search that now looks like it's going to take a little bit longer than expected. The four-time MVP quarterback returned to South Florida yesterday after weekend visits to the Broncos and the Cardinals, but not before reportedly scheduling visits with the Dolphins and the Titans on the verge of this afternoon's start with the NFL League's free agent period. The Denver Post reported that Broncos had begun contract talks with Manning, but even if that is the case, what has been reported to be Manning's personal deadline for signing today appeared likely to pass without decision. Now, I think Denver has an excellent shot. John Elway does not like Tim Tebow. However, the fans love Tim Tebow, but, you know, it would be a coup because Elway would be able to get rid of Tebow and shut the fans up by replacing him with Peyton Manning. How could you bitch by getting rid of Tebow for Peyton Manning? You couldn't. Now, one media outlet reported Manning also would speak with the Texans, but the Houston Broncos, according to high-ranking team sources, is saying Houston is sticking with Matt Chubb and has no interest in Manning. Curiously, however, the Texans appeared to be creating room under the salary cap for a significant move when they confirmed late yesterday that starting right tackle Eric Winston, considered one of the league's best players at his position, had been abruptly released. The surprise decision to cut Winston was surely caught the attention of a tackle-needy Jets, saved Houston roughly $5 million under NFL's $126 million cap. Meanwhile, Manning is supposed to meet with new Dolphins coach Joe Philbin and other Miami football executives today or tomorrow. Miami owner Stephen Ross would also plan to make a lavish proposal to Manning on his visit, reportedly is being excluded as a quarterback's request because Manning wants to only focus on football. Now, speaking of Miami, Miami wide receiver, number one wide receiver, Brandon Marshall, was traded this afternoon to my Chicago Bears. Brandon Marshall, excellent receiver. You may or may not recall some of the badass catches he made against the Jets on a Monday Night Football. The kid is definitely a number one receiver. He's definitely going to make it happen with Cutler. I think it's definitely a great signing. That's a great signing for Chicago. He's a big receiver. He's a number one receiver. Good possession guy. I mean, he makes tough catches. I mean, it's a great move for Chicago. He is a little bit of a problem guy. I do admit that. But I don't think he's going to have a problem up in Chicago. He's played with Cutler before. And I just think it's a good move by Chicago. Now, if we could just get one more badass offensive lineman, the Bears would be well on their way to making a return to the Super Bowl. Okay, speaking of a returner and return to a lineup, with the competition for the Yankees starting rotation moving from the compulsory exercises to activities that weigh a lot more, Ivan Nova needs to find the strike zone better against the Red Sox tonight than he did in his last outing last week against the Blue Jays. Nova, a 16-game winner last year, wasn't guaranteed a spot manager Joe Girardi's five-man rotation that only includes two gimmies, obviously CC Sabathia and the Japanese guy, Hiroki Kuroda, from the Dodgers that we got from the Dodgers. After that, Nova is competing with Michael Pineda, Phil Hughes, and Freddie Garcia for three spots. We're getting closer to evaluations. You have to see some progress going to the third start, Girardi said. You take a hard look at the fourth and fifth starts. He struggled with commanding his fastball the first couple of starts, and that's important to me. Nova, who said he hopes he can locate his fastball for strikes tonight, is confident he can throw fastballs for strikes, but is puzzled how different the results are in bullpen sessions compared to his two exhibition outings. I am perfect in the bullpen, but I get in the game and I try to do too much, said Nova, who gave up five runs and five hits to the Blue Jays in 2 2/3 innings. The fastball is a problem right now, but I know I'll get it back. Now, On the good news, Nova's fastball has been clocked at 93 to 96, so velocity isn't the problem. Just a little bit of location. I've got faith in Nova, and like he's, you know, he said himself, he feels that he's, you know, he's trying to do too much. So, you know, if he just, you know, just backs it down a notch, doesn't try to do too much, I think Nova, you know, is a lock for the rotation. You know, I see Nova being, you know, the number three or the number four starter. I think that Dickey should be the number two starter, but, you know, they signed this clown from Seattle, who's, you know, very good, and they probably want to make him the number two starter eventually. I don't think the Japanese guy, even though he's a lock for the rotation, my personal opinion, he's not the number two starter. And I think you'll see as the season pans out that he's not going to be the number two starter. I think it might be Pineda, or I think, you know, in my opinion, it should be Nova, because Nova is badass. That kid's tough. We've seen him pitch in the playoffs. He's got nails of steel. Not scared of any of the hitters, and, you know, I just think he deserves it, but, you know, I'm not Joe Girardi, and we'll just have to wait and see. So, another guy that certainly, you know, deserves something is Jabba Chamberlain. Now, back in 07, you know, he was the phenom, and, you know, last year, he had the injury, Tommy John surgery, and, you know, now he's back. You know, he's back. He's ahead of schedule, which you got to like. You know, he says he'll never live up to what he did initially. I mean, how could he? And those early magical moments, you know, you could project whatever you wanted while watching him. The next Josh Beckett, or the next Mariano Rivera, which I had him as pegged as. You know, he began the next season as a number three prospect in the majors, according to Baseball America. And it's felt like a zigzagging descent down the mountain. Since, you know, Lynn expectations, import of role, and ultimate health. Chamberlain, as I said, needed Tommy John surgery last June, which leaves us all wondering yet again, you know, who is he and what's he going to be after that? The mystery around Chamberlain is, you know, it's still unraveling and it's far from resolved. The righty threw a bullpen session yesterday of 30 fastballs and 8 sliders, and the only indicator of recent surgery was the catcher Gustav Molina swatted on the plate to handle the breaking pitches. Chamberlain does not graduate to a 60-foot, 6-inch slider until Friday, but his matriculation to date has gone rather flawlessly. He reports no pain and rather the joys of releasing a ball without anguish. Molina described smooth mechanics, good angles, and live fastballs. Sometimes after the surgery, guys are better. Very true, guys are better. Pitching coach Larry Rothschild said Chamberlain has forgotten himself and is ahead of schedule in a good way. You know, the schedule, like in 07, Chamberlain is in a rush again. He said he's pulling a Mariano, equating his refusal to publicize with when he thinks he will be ready to Rivera's decision not to say whether he is or is not retiring. But Chavez is not a good poker player with this kind of information. Every answer betrayed his personal belief that he will be ready to open the season. However, again, yesterday, GM Brian Cashman issued a no-chance doctrine on Chamberlain to open the season, and that the target return to the majors is still roughly 12 months from surgery, you know, which obviously is June. You know, in the best scenario, Chamberlain comes back to form a powerhouse to set up, you know, Robertson and Rafael Soriano in front of Rivera and gets himself back into discussion to be Rivera's successor. Me, personally, that's what I think Jabba should be. I said it all along. He has the mental makeup to be Mariano Rivera, and he's also a big guy. Granted, I love Dave Robertson, but he has a small frame, and I don't think you can throw that hard on a small frame forever. Mariano Rivera throws the same kind of pitch, and it moves, and it's not a lot of it isn't based on speed. I mean, Rivera tells you right where he's throwing the ball, but you can't hit it. A lot of times, Robertson is just throwing the ball by you, and there's a big difference. You know, Robertson and Rivera are probably about the same size. I just don't think Robertson can do what he can do for a long period of time. I'm rooting for him to do so, and I love Dave Robertson. He's got nerves of steel, but I don't think he's the closer of the future. I think Jabba Chamberlain is, and I think Jabba Chamberlain, you know, needs to get his act together this year, because in my belief, I think Rivera will probably
you know, obviously he's going to pitch out this season, and I think maybe you could split the duties for one more season between Chamberlain and Rivera before he hands the reins over. Because I don't think we're ready to do just a total handover of the reins. Like, here, take it. You're the closer now. I just don't think it's, you know, the Yankees are ready for that. And I think, you know, it would, I think Rivera would probably like to groom Chamberlain to become the next Mariano. I don't think he just wants to just go, you know, here. Here, kid, take it and go. So I think, you know, if they could split the duties next year, I think that would be, you know, that would be great. But, you know, again, we'll have to wait and see. And but that's what makes things interesting. And, you know, next thing you know, it'll be first pitch. I can't wait, really, for baseball season to get started. It's going to be a great season. Okay. That's it for this week. Shout out to all my Woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at ASS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, my partner, Money Mike. Weather's been fantastic. Let's hope for more of it. Next thing you know, the leaves will be popping and the grass will be green. That's
all
it
right,
for this week, everybody.
Thank you, Woody. Just a little bit more news for you. We've blown through most of it, but we have one left from Altanut. Got propaganda? Why all of the milk industry's health claims have been proven wrong. And this is by Martha Rosenberg. Selling milk looks easy and even fun when you see the celebrity milk mustache ads. Got milk? Ads may be the most recognizable and spooked of all ad campaigns. Yet they are probably also one of the least successful. Milk sales have actually fallen every year since the ad began. The National Dairy Promotion and Research Program and the National Fluid Milk Processor Promotion Program admit consumption has been declining for decades in the United States at about 1% per year in the yearly reports to Congress, but plead that their marketing has helped mitigate at least some of the decline. Why the milk drinking slide. First, many U.S. groups do not drink milk much or any milk, including ethnic minorities, those who are lactose intolerant or allergic, dieters, the health conscious, and vegans. Kids themselves often dislike milk, probably why they invented chocolate and flavored milks, and it is often the last choice among teens and tweens on whom much milk marketing is focused. Healthcare professionals, unless subsidized by the dairy industry, seldom recommend milk because of its cholesterol, fat, calories, allergens, and impurities, and a possible link to RBGH, recombinant bovine growth hormone, since milk made with the cow milk enhancer has never been labeled. Benjamin Spock, the famous baby boom era pediatrician, recommended no milk for children after age 2. To reduce the risks of heart disease, obesity, high blood pressure, diabetes, and diet-related cancers. Milk marketers admit that the public's preference for milk may be changing, but also blame calcium-fortified juices and vitamin-enhanced beverages that undermine milk's healthy image. They also point the finger at limited availability of milk in eating establishments and even milk prices. You can't find milk anywhere, and when you do, you can't afford it, they claim. The agencies note that national milk sales are falling because the proportion of children under 6 has not grown much. And as the proportion of African Americans in the population increases, a group not known to be big milk drinkers due to the higher rates of lactose intolerance. Milk marketers have tried everything to reverse falling sales. During the 1980s, when the slogan was, milk, it does the body good, they began marketing milk for strong bones to prevent osteoporosis. 1 in 5 victims of osteoporosis is male, said milk ads featuring model Tyra Banks as the mustache campaign debuted. Don't worry. Calcium can help prevent it. Another early mustache ad with musician Mark Anthony read, shake it, don't break it. Want strong bones? Drinking enough low milk now can prevent osteoporosis later. But the campaign had both marketing and scientific problems. Tweens and teens don't worry much about old people's diseases like osteoporosis because who's going to get old? And African Americans, Latinos, and men's groups targeted in the Strong Bone campaign are the least at risk for osteoporosis, says doctors. Whoops!
Health professionals also dispute the bone claims. 2001 USDA expert panel reports said the calcium intake by itself, as milk offers, does not prevent osteoporosis because exercise and nutrients other than calcium are part of the bone health picture. And panelists also said whole milk would increase the risk of prostate cancer and heart disease, and that should include such warnings. And other experts, like T. Colin Campbell, author of China Study, and heart expert Dean Omish of the Preventive Medicine Research Institute, agree that osteoporosis and fractures not caused by the marketers not caused by what marketers were presenting as milk deficiencies. In fact, the Western diet, which often has too much protein and acid, is blamed for some researchers and nutritionists for osteoporosis and fractures. The popular proton pump inhibitors like Nexium, Prevacid, and Prilosec, which people take for acid reflux, are also blamed for fractures.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Now, in 2002,
milk marketers
told Congress they were marketing the scientific benefits of milk for osteoporosis, breast cancer, hypertension, especially focusing on African Americans. The Fluid Milk Board continues to spotlight the high incidence of high blood pressure among African Americans and to promote milk and milk byproducts as dietary solutions as part of the DASH dietary approach to stop hypertension diet, said the report should be a barrier to include milk. The program also addresses misconceptions about lactose intolerance and shows why it should not be a barrier to including milk in a diet. The board launches a new lactose intolerance initiative that focuses on educating African Americans on the importance of incorporating milk into their diet. And the program provided educational material on osteoporosis. Milk marketers may also have taken a cue from the cartoon character Joe Camel.
From the cartoon character.
Cartoon character, rather, used by R.J. Reynolds to market Camel cigarettes. Milk containers were redesigned into new handy-friendly decanters called the Chug, and a spoofy musical group was rolled out on YouTube and socialized network sites called White Gold and the Calcium Twins. And the Got Milk site also ran an animated cartoon of a farm depicting happy cows, chickens, ducks, and pigs. Well, and horses working out on a treadmill while milk cartons moved by on a conveyor belt. A helium balloon propped up continually saying, "Tell your friends." And you think drinking calcium fortified beverages like soy drinks and orange juice will meet your bones requirements, as the site, which was live until 2008. Not really, said research that includes 75% of calcium added to popular beverages gets left at the bottom of the carton. Whoa. But then a disclaimer pops up and confesses that milk actually benefits for bones, PMS, sleep, teeth, hair, muscles,
the article kind of goes on.
But you might want to check it out. It's, if you go to Alternet and check that one out, Got Propaganda. So if you drink milk, that's your problem. I love cheese, unfortunately. I'm a big cheese eater, and I really do enjoy that.
But anyway, we've come to the end of our show,
mm-hmm.
and we want to thank you for being with us tonight. And please tune in tomorrow night for with
our very big show again tomorrow.
With Tex Mars, our part three of our interview, to find out why the Illuminati have acted like they have in their plan for
China,
Die America Die,
exactly.
and why China is the chosen country to be top dog in the world. So tune in tomorrow night to find out, and we appreciate that you've been with us, and thank you very much, and have a great night.